Hello, everyone. I'm Robbie Dorman, and this is the Serial Fanaticist, the podcast for fans of everything. Welcome. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Bradley Goodnight, and we are talking about DMing again. Dungeon mastering. Or GMing. Game mastering. Whatever. Brad joined me way back at the beginning of the podcast, and now we are revisiting the subject. We talk about setting proper player expectations, about public tabletop events, and about when to quit a campaign. Brad is very thoughtful, and I love talking about D&D and tabletop in general with him. I hope you enjoy it. On to the discussion. Hello, everyone. I am joined by Dr. Bradley Goodnight.
Thank you. Appreciate the emphasis on doctor. Thank you.
Doctor?
Yeah. Worked hard for it. You can say it a third time. That's good. Four is too many, though. Please just leave it at three.
Okay. Well, no more mention it. No, I will never call you a doctor again.
You can't even say it again.
How are you doing, Brad?
Doing quite well. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm okay. A-okay, even though we didn't play D&D today.
Yeah, I was actually very saddened about that. Scheduling is kind of a beast. It's terrible.
It is.
It's the hardest part of D&D.
It is. That Fellowship of the Ring meme.
Yeah.
Always accurate. Always.
It's the true magic of D&D is getting a handful of adults to be available at the same time together. It's very difficult.
We're going to be talking about DMing, dungeon mastering, which feels silly when you say it like that.
Sounds awesome when you say it like that. But game mastering maybe more broadly, because we're also going to be talking about your Call of Cthulhu game, which is not done. There's no dungeons involved.
No, I mean, yet.
Well, you know what? I'm sorry. I didn't mean to step on your creativity there. There may or may not be dungeons at some point. I don't mean to rule it out.
Call of Cthulhu, you're a keeper, to be fair. If you want to follow their... Because every single system has to have their own dumb name for the person that runs the game. You can't just be the game runner or the game master. You have to be a keeper or an oracle or whatever awful, dumb, nerdy word. We sat down and talked about stuff about DMing, like 2 years ago now, probably.
Wow.
It was the latter end of 2016.
Yeah, I think you're right.
When we first touched on it, and things have changed. We've wrapped up campaigns, started new ones. You have started running a big giant thing in Atlanta locally. And I've started running Call of Cthulhu for you and others. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, I think we have a lot more games under our belt. I think we've learned a lot about dungeon mastering, game mastering in the interim.
The key takeaway, I believe, from that first discussion was read The Lazy DM.
I think low prep, and I still stand by that, actually. My philosophy has not changed. I think that I believe it more fully now than I did. But I've learned some other things. But yeah, I think... Should we summarize the conversation before?
We don't have to worry about that. You can go. That's like episode like two or something. I don't know. It was a very early on episode of this very podcast. You can go listen to that if you want to listen to all that. But I just want.
But the continuity is not important. Like you don't have to watch the pre. Yeah.
No. Ask you who is Batman's girlfriend.
It makes sense. This is a completely new origin story. It's a reboot, basically. Like, you don't need that prior knowledge.
Now the Green Goblin is the reason that Peter Parker got his powers. It's not just some random spider.
But you're not going to be confused coming in halfway through,
no,
is what I'm saying.
No.
Okay.
No, you don't.
That sounds good.
I don't think so. We finished, and I think this is the thing, the first thing that popped in my head, I was like, I should talk to Brad some more about this, is, because it's an interesting thing that I don't think a lot of people actually do, is we finished a campaign.
Yeah.
Like, it wrapped up, it ended, characters walked off into the sunset or whatever.
Well, it was a little bit of a dark, I guess it wasn't that much of a downer ending.
I mean.
A little bit.
We got out of Barovia.
Yeah, we need to be careful about spoilers, though, don't we? Because it was a module.
I'm going to there will be warnings ahead of time before little intro. We can avoid major spoilers, but it's not. I don't really. I don't. We don't need to discuss like specific plot points or anything necessarily.
Sense. And it, you know, we took it off the rails to some degree too, which is how every campaign goes, especially when it stretches on a long time. Like, never ends up where you anticipate at the start. But
yeah, we played through. Cool. We played through Curse of Strahd, and we finished it.
Yeah, and just a few bargains with Eldritch entities, strange powers, insanity. I think it went pretty much according to plan, wrapped up very nicely. Neat little bow on it at the end.
I made no bargains.
You did have that sentient bone that kind of worked with you.
But he was my friend.
It was fine. I guess there was no bargain per se. No, there was.
No, I just picked it up, and no one else could pick it up because everyone else in the party was evil or not good, I guess, actually.
That's true.
I was good, so I could touch it.
Yeah. It was an interesting choice to play a goodly character in that sort of campaign, too, especially on kind of a team of a-holes, that it's a fun choice to be the kind of more stalwart or straight and narrow character. I think that's a fun dynamic. I played a paladin in a group that was like kind of murder hobo-y for a long time, so I know the feel.
I know. By the time of end of Curse of Strahd, I think we are all were like very much ready. Like I, both as a player and as my character, was very similar. Like whatever, get to this. We got to finish this, or hold on. Life is tenuous.
I really loved that personally. I think that to me, but it's also the kind of games that I really like to run, that I think I told y'all that going in. I hope I did a good enough job of saying that this module is kind of designed to grind you down, and so that by the end you pray for death. And those are the kind of games I like to run that are very psychological, and that your characters, it's not like a good time for them, that they undergo changes, not all of which are good. And I loved, my favorite part in the whole campaign is y'all came in and were like considerably more heroic. But there was a certain point when you were fleeing from something on horseback and you saw a village that you had been to that like friends of yours were in, and it was on fire, and you decided not to go and help and just like kept kind of beelining towards where you were going. That at that point you were just so fed up with the world you were in that you like had this agenda, this like purpose, and you wouldn't be distracted by like other things, and were even starting to act in like much less heroic ways. I'm just a sucker for like arcs in that way. I really like it.
I think we all had, all the characters had a pretty good, I don't know, it's very, is that, I don't know, I've never, like, trying to keep that in mind while you're running a game of each character having an arc as well as the overall arc of the story, how much does that shape how you run the game?
I think for me, I guess that, I think I'd said this before on the previous talk that we'd had, so I know I'm rehashing some old ground, but that to me, it's, I think that a lot of DMs put too much emphasis on things that don't matter as much. I think making like your perfect monster and really worrying a whole lot about like creating some brand new monster with a bunch of abilities, the players never see any of that information, that you write it down on a piece of paper and then they never actually see most of its attacks. Like they might kill it too quickly. Or if it does attack them, they don't notice like how interesting it is, that taking any other out of the book monster and just reskinning it, you get a lot more bang for the buck. I think what characters really notice, and you've seen in games of mine that you've played in, that my favorite moments are when I am able to weave in a character's backstory and make something in the world connect to that in a way they didn't expect. That I think my favorite part from the other game that we're running, the one in Faerun and the Storm King's Thunder game, but where Sylvia, like she encountered, it was actually in the module. It was like one of the adventures that you can have, but I just made the character her brother. And I think that added so much more emotional depth to it, I thought. And it's a very simple thing to do. I think people spend a lot of time with like world building when really just making certain aspects of the game connect to people's backstories. Or you think about what emotionally resonates with this person and try to put something in that's going to kind of touch them in that way. I think it adds a lot more depth to it. So I don't know that I answered your question appropriately. You're asking like how to do it.
I know, not necessarily how, but ethos, you know, and I believe you answered it.
I think if anyone watches Matt Mercer and Critical Role, I think actually Matt Coville has a YouTube video. He's another DM who does like how to DM YouTube series.
The owner of the most successful tabletop Kickstarter of all time.
He's amazing. But I think he talked about the difference in like his philosophy versus Matt Mercer's, and I thought it was interesting, but how Matt's games, they center around the players a little bit more, that like the world, like it seems like a world they live in and they inhabit. So it doesn't feel like it circles around them, but he intentionally puts things in the world, like a boss fight that really is going to bring out a certain aspect of this character. That one of my favorite parts from the former season of Critical Role, there's, I guess it's really hard to explain if you haven't seen it, but they encounter someone who's like in a, it's sort of a Fisher King-esque scenario. There's like a swamp that is really sick because there's this person, this like toxic individual who's there in the center of the swamp, and the whole place is sick because of their presence. And then his interaction with this one character, and he kind of told her like how worthless she was, and that it really resonated with her, like character's own fears about herself and her own feelings of inadequacy. That's what I mean, that the world is there as a way to get them to explore this thing about their character they find interesting. Mm-hmm. That you put things in their way, you put hurdles and roadblocks that really challenge them. It's how Pixar writes stories, that, you know, there's this like kind of there's a thing that a character is moving towards, and then there's something in their way, and then maybe the place they end up isn't where they expect it to be. They either achieve it or they don't, but they get something else they expected. It's the hero's journey, actually. It's what is his name? Dan Harmon talks about too.
Yes, there's this various.
Yeah, I'm mentioning this if like Dan Harmon came up with it, but like it's an older idea.
No, invented it. What's the guy's name? I should know this. I should know the guy who.
You're talking about the author who originally.
Hero's Journey, the famously like labeled it the Hero's Journey. I'm an idiot.
This is Campbell.
Yes, Campbell. Campbell's the Hero's Journey. That is 100% correct. That kind of shape of character arcs is mm-hmm. kind of tried and true.
Yeah. It's amazing that it never gets old, because like every movie we watch, with some exceptions, not every, I'm exaggerating, but it does never get old, or it seems to never. And I think that when you can make that pay off, when you can have someone encounter something that they think they know how they should deal with it, but then their normal kind of way of dealing with it doesn't work, and then they have to try something new, and then they learn something about themselves, like that, the more you can insert that in. And so I try to, I guess, incorporate that into my games when I can. And I feel like when it really kind of achieves more is when you manage to pull that off. It doesn't always work. I think episodic writing, I think, works well too. Is this okay? I'm just giving advice on like other ways to do it.
No, go to it. We're just riffing, man.
Yeah, that's how we do. Okay, then I think that something I've learned, because we've been running a lot of one-shots at the event that I run in Atlanta, but that I think episodic gameplay seems to work really well. It's what Chris Perkins, who wrote Curse of Strahd, that he talked about, like there being kind of every time you sit down to a session, thinking about it like an episode of Bonanza or something, where, or The Simpsons or anything, like that it has its own sort of theme. Like this is the episode where they go underwater. This is the episode where they're in a desert, and kind of thinking about that way and just working in as many ideas as you can that fit the theme. And you can have things that deviate. It doesn't all have to be keeping with that. But that when you think about it episodically, that it can help a little bit, at least for me creatively. So I don't know if that's helpful or not, but the main thing that I think is, and I think the events we run too, because it's so improv focused, that we run games with completely new people. We don't have any like signups for our event. People just come in. Sometimes I would say off the street, but like really there are people who are at the bar and they don't even know we're doing D&D, and they're like, oh, what, D&D? I've never played. And then they just join a table, and we have to deal with these people that we've never met. We don't know anything about them. And improv becomes really important there. But I think building up your improv chops, taking an improv class, that does the most to make you a good DM. I think focusing too much on, you know, on building out your world and lore and, you know, designing new monsters, that I think that's where a lot of people put a lot of their time, and they sink a lot of time into it, when I think getting better at improv. And for me, even like thinking of the motivations of my NPCs, like trying to get into their heads a little bit and figuring out what's a realistic motivation for them, I feel like that pays more dividends than making a really cool monster.
But what if it has three tails?
I think, wow, I didn't think about that. Yeah, three tails, that's like two more than normal.
And one, like the other tails do different things than that first tail.
You're blowing my mind right now. So like the tails are not all the same.
No, like first tail is poison. And then the second tail does, like, acid.
And if you just slow down, because I'm writing this down.
Okay, the third tail is lightning.
What? That doesn't... Tails don't usually... Because poison, I was like, yeah, you know, sometimes tails have poison. It's very rare for tails to have lightning.
Right, I know.
That's...
crazy. Boom, universe.
That's amazing. Brain has changed my view.
Universal. That's universal brain monster creation. What was the biggest? So that, how long did Curse of Strahd fit? Like 2 years? Did we play?
I think it was a long nearly. Time. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a really good game, though. Y'all were a really good group, which I think that led to, I think, it being so fun and, like, lasting the whole time. When you have a good, solid group where people fit well together, that makes a world of difference. I think I couldn't have persisted. And actually, I did run other groups through Curse of Strahd. We didn't make it all the way. They just didn't mesh as well. But you were asking what was difficult?
Yeah, what was the hardest? What was, aside from the scheduling, I think... We can always assume this is probably one of the out of game. I would say in game challenges.
Man, I think that I'm trying to think. I am a little bit of a perfectionist, and I think that running something new, like a very big, large battle, or anything that like put me out of my comfort zone, that was what was hard. That like playing an NPC that really wasn't like an NPC I'd run before. That's what's weird, because like I have a lot of experience DMing, but occasionally you have a character you have to play as that, I don't know, they have like a weird accent or a lisp or something that like I'm not even 100% comfortable doing, or doing accents that are, I think that was what was difficult for me. And it happened all the time. It wasn't one instance. That I think that having to continuously challenge myself by doing something that was unusual and different, and the players force you to a lot of the time, and you can't always prepare. But if I know, like, there's this NPC, there's a witch in the woods, and, like, she talks like this, I can prep for that. But if you guys, one of my favorite things in the game, do y'all remember when you went for brunch? Do you remember your brunch adventure? Maybe not.
I don't, it feels like, I'm pondering, and I'm, like, I'm trying to remember.
It was not in Barovia. There's no brunch in Barovia. That it was in the Storm King's Thunder game.
Oh, okay, yes, I remember that. Yeah, I was, like, I was trying to remember brunch in Strahd. I'm, like... No.
It did happen in Strahd.
Does Strahd let people eat brunch? I thought
you didn't ask him. You know, you did not actually.
That's true.
Did not accept his invitation into castle. Didn't have.
He wasn't a very approachable guy most of the time.
Look, you just didn't give him a chance. Is what I'm saying.
Okay. I remember our brunch experience. Yes.
So what I mean is, like, I think it was funny to me after. So. Basically, you were in, I'm trying to remember, it was Moon something, it's the Harper Central town, Moongleam Tower is where you were, and then you asked the person who was there, who was part of the secret organization, to, like, show you around the town, and then you asked him, like, where you could go get brunch, and then so you went to this brunch restaurant, and there was this sort of, it wasn't really a murder mystery, but something that happened there, and then you asked him, like, what bars there were, and he mentioned a few, and then one of them was called, like, the Bloody Wand. And he said they do wizard duels there. So you all went and did wizard duels. And do you remember this?
Yes, I remember.
There was like a group of different wizards that you had to kind of take on tournament style, one-on-one. The point was, like, afterwards, I, like, closed the book and, like, we turned off Roll 20. And then Jessica, my wife, who was part of the game, she was like, yeah, that was like a really fun adventure. Like or something about how, like, she was surprised at how fleshed out it was in the book. I'm like, there's no brunch section in the module I was running. Like, there is no appendix for brunch. Like, that was completely by the seat of my pants. The entire thing, of course, was completely made up. Like, I just had to roll with the punches, but I thought it was the best compliment that she thought that there was in the book, like, all this stuff laid out. But it only provides like a few details, and you have to be willing to, at least the way that I try to DM is to not lead the players. I try to follow them, and then y'all make it really hard to keep up sometimes when you just, which I loved. I loved that. I felt like I had succeeded. The world seemed open enough that you were like, yeah, there's probably a brunch place here. Like, let's go. And then I just had to then like just completely pull stuff like out of my trousers and create a brunch menu for you. And then you find a place where there's like all these different combatants that you can fight against. But then when I managed to pull it off, it feels really good. And I'm just now revealing to you that was not all pre-planned. I'm telling you now, which there's a little bit of like piercing the veil what is the expression? Pardon the kimono.
Pardon the kimono. That famous saying that everyone uses.
That old folksy idiom that I hear all the time.
Yeah. But... I was just at the general store the other day and all the old timers.
we're throwing
that around.
Yeah.
Yep. Old part in the kimono.
Yeah, that is how they. That's how they sound. Too,
that's how
yeah.
they sound. Yeah, especially in Canada, they have Maine accents in Canada.
At the old Canada General store up there.
Yep.
But that It's so, called. But it, what I'm saying,
Brad, it's, oh, it's called Max. Is the
gotcha?
It's a chain.
Well, but I mention it because I think in general, it's the reason I mentioned Pardon the Kimono is because in general, it's not good to ever reveal to your players when you came up with something on the fly because it ruins the mystique, and that is something I'm bad at. I think I tend to share more with you guys than I probably should. I tend to, because I'm just like impressed by my own cleverness sometimes that like I managed to pull it off, and so I want to tell you or Jess like, oh, and I just, but it really ruins the game, and it's really important to never, I know I just did it, so I guess I'm saying do as I say, but I do recommend to avoid the temptation, never tell your players when something was invented on the fly. Always try to keep that barrier up, like the DM screen, like don't share your details. Don't explain how smart or clever or witty something was. Like, make them feel and like believe in the living, breathing world that you always kind of keep it secret. And that I have trouble with that.
You got to keep it. You got to keep it kayfabe. Is what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly. I wouldn't have put it that way, but that is exactly right.
Everything and is wrestling, Brad. You gotta.
It's true.
The world.
There are many lessons that I think that can be learned from wrestling.
From there's the stubborn idiocy of not revealing that everything is an act.
Yeah, and like we all know, I mean, of course, the players know it's fantasy. They're sitting at a table and rolling dice, like they get it. But then you have to, as the DM, you have to kind of believe in it more than them. You have to be the one who is the kind of keeper of secrets and takes it a little more seriously than they do. They can talk about strategy. They can talk meta. But I feel like you as the DM, and this is kind of just my personal rule. I think I've played with a lot of DMs who they get really into the mechanics and the meta. Mm-hmm. And I think that's fine, actually. That can be a really fun and good game. But I think that it can be nice to keep that layer of separation a little bit. That if you can give off a little bit of an air of mystery and keep your secrets, then I think it adds to the enjoyment of it. That you're a bit of a magician, I think. And so just like with magic, if you know what the trick is, it really ruins it. I'm talking about magic. Yeah, not actual literal magic. So just, does it make sense that...
I thought you were talking about Magic the Gathering.
I think that also, you like you have to keep your cards close to your chest.
We stop in the middle of a D&D game to play Magic the Gathering.
Yeah, that's how.
I have a red blue deck.
It's how, instead of rolling, I think we just decide play Magic with a quick combat Magic.
One quick game.
few hours, it's much simpler, because we don't always want to carry dice.
Does that... You run, because, are you, how many games are you running right now?
That I DM?
Yeah.
I think I have to separate from the event, because we have, not very many. I've reduced the number, which I'm very happy about, because I was running 4 at some point, and I've since reduced it to just to 1. I think your game is the only one I'm running still.
Oh, okay.
But then I still run one-shots at the event. I have given up all the campaigns I was doing so that I can focus on the D&D event that we do.
All right.
So
the question was driving at trying to balance multiple campaigns all at once. I know you were running. You just said running 4. That seems like a lot.
It was too much. I think that I definitely went overboard, and it was fun. I think it was a fun challenge because I was actually running the same module for 2 of the games, and so. Some of my notes would kind of get crisscrossed that I would give a handout to one group and it would mention a character that wasn't in their game. And I only had that happen once, but it was rather embarrassing. And I think that it's better to keep it to a smaller number, I believe. But at the same time, I think when you DM the way that I do, where it's really improv focused, I think it's much easier that you don't have to do anywhere near as much prep, that you can run more games. And what's really nice, too, that if you are playing in a game and the DM can't make it, or there's not, like, one of the players who's really important isn't there, and someone else has to pick up and run, like, having those improv chops can allow you to step in and, like, do something off the cuff. I think it's, like, a fun challenge, actually, to run completely improvised games, and the more you do it, the easier it gets, but it really improves, I think, running even a game from a module, even a well-planned game, that running a few that are completely improvised will really... kind of strengthen that ability. It's like a muscle.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that just doing more improv work helps.
I mean, I think it's also a measure of, a measure of your confidence in it.
Yeah.
Like, I just by running some games and having to, you know, think on my feet and mm-hmm. come up with, oh, yeah, you're at this place. Yeah, totally. I definitely am playing this bar or whatever out or room, wherever you are at. Yeah, definitely. Just having to do that over, it's practice makes perfect. It's, you know, it is,
yeah.
You do it enough times and it's not like you weren't able to do that before. I think it is a fear often of DMs is that if you are improvising things versus planning things, people, the players will notice, you know, they'll go, oh yeah, he's just pulling this out of his ass. And they're, and you'll,
they don't, they no, do not,
they don't. No, they,
it's
they,
shocking the degree to which they do not. In fact, a lot of times when I'm trying to run something that I've planned to a T, it feels more stilted. And I think it actually makes them think that I'm improvising then. When I'm actually improvising, I tend to flow better.
Yeah.
And at least the times that I've improvised is when I've gotten the most positive feedback, which is why I think I do it more. But that the improv games, people love it a lot more. They don't feel railroaded. When you're following the players and not leading the players, it's really impossible to railroad because there's no road whatsoever. They just make, like, everyone's making it up as they go. I feel like it's the true beauty of D&D too, because if you have a story written for them, it might as well be a story you've written and just give them the book that you've written or the screenplay. That D&D is unique in its, what is the word? It's the interactivity of it,
mm-hmm.
that the give and take with the players, that they are not just participants, like they are also kind of authors in a way. And I think by giving them more of that power and letting them lead the direction, I think that it leans into the strength of D&D as opposed to what might actually work better as a book or a podcast or a movie.
Or a video game.
Or a video game. But even video games, they allow limited degrees of choice, but that D&D allows maximal choice. So if you railroad too much, if you have too much of the story written, you are making it more like a video game when D&D can be so much more if you really play to its strengths.
I mean, I think the growth, like I see lots of articles online, you know, like, and it's not just D&D. It's like every, like all art, like I've seen more and more press for relatively small, you know, games that aren't, D&D has Wizards of the Coast behind it to push it and has lots of, you know, has Critical Role and Matt Colville and like very big YouTube presences. Mm-hmm. How do you pluralize presence?
It's,
I'm not sure.
I think presences. Probably.
That sounds bad. I don't like how it sounds. But like even like beyond D&D, like I feel like there's even more and more attention paid to smaller games that are more niche. And I think that appeal of and also talks about how the people playing them are outside of demographics you would expect, like outside of that very traditional, like, you know, 18 to 35 year old dude. And I feel it is because the open-ended nature of the choices of character of not appealing. Like if you read books or movies or play video games, a large part of them like follow same kind of trajectory of power fantasy. And by giving people more choices about how characters act and do be like, they can still be heroes even, but they are different kind of heroes, and giving those people those choices like is immediately like exciting because they've never encountered that in fiction.
I love it too, because I think it's a game where it doesn't have to be combat focused if you choose for it to not be. And I think that very few video games can ever get away from the combat centrality, that like they have to have combat kind of as its core mechanic. And D&D is probably of some of the available RPGs might even be the worst example because it is so combat centric, but you can have whole sessions. We have had whole sessions where it's just talking, it's just role play, engaging with NPCs, engaging with the other players. That's really unusual, that there are no video games like that that are completely just about dialogue with other people.
There are. I mean,
they might just be niche or like indie. What are you thinking?
I mean, the walking simulators.
But even then, it's not about interacting with other people at the table with you, is what I mean.
Oh yeah, well, you're experiencing a story. It's just there's no combat. Yeah. But
I think that's what's impressive, that because it's to me that was like in Game of Thrones, for instance. Like when I read the first book, that to me that was the most engaging part of it, was all the intrigue, all the stuff happening at King's Landing, and how out of his depth Ned Stark was, and like all the machinations that you can do that in D&D. You can actually like be a participant in things like that. Whereas a game, it's much harder to pull that off. That it has to just be usually, you know, lines of enemies, you hit them with an axe, Which that's fine. Like I have the new God of War, and like that's a fine way for a game to be. But that it's amazing that there can be something different. I think D&D taps into this whole different realm of human experience, which is it's all about, or it can be all about dialogue, or you can do 50-50. You can run whatever kind of game you want. It allows so much variety and variability. And I think that's why it appeals to people that might feel kind of left behind, or just uninterested in other styles of gameplay. Same with like there's tons of tabletop games like board games that can be like either extremely simple or extremely complex, intricate, that they can appeal to a wide variety of people and they're like the kind of thing they find interesting. So I think, but D&D can be that depending on the if you get the right group of people, it can be a completely different kind of game.
Speaking of groups of people,
Uh-huh.
and you're so this event you run in Atlanta. I've
Yeah.
seen. I know you're how once a week. Right? Or is it
Twice.
twice a
We run every
wow?
Monday and Tuesday. Yeah.
Jeez, twice a week.
And that's why I don't run four games anymore. But I still am apparently a glutton for punishment, and so I run this twice a week.
Twice a week. Oof. That's so you're it's basically open jump in D&D.
I love it. It's actually, I think that it's, I'm happy because I feel like it's act, I'm acting a little bit on my philosophy for how games should be, which it might not be for everybody, but that we do a D&D open mic-esque thing. So we have dungeon masters from all over Atlanta come in and they have an idea for a game they want to run that night. And it's all one shots. And one shot meaning that the game begins and ends that night, like it doesn't continue past 10 p.m. So at 7, people basically pitch their idea, and someone will say, like, I'm running a game that's kind of Skyrim inspired where you're all dwarves. And someone else will say, like, I'm running a game where you're all in a frat and you're trying to break into the vampire fraternity. It's like Revenge of the Nerds, but the other frat, the jocks are all vampires. And these were games people ran, and they just pitched like the craziest, most kind of bananas ideas. And all these DMs, they really challenge themselves because every week they have to like come up with a more interesting pitch than the previous week, especially if they didn't get any takers. They want to like step it up and like do something. They keep challenging themselves and each other to do more and more weird and interesting stuff. But they pitch their idea, and then the players who come that night, no one signs up. They just say, like, okay, vampire frat party, like that sounds good. I'll go to that table. Or, you're running Fantasy Harvard, like, or you're running, like, all these different ideas people come up with. Players just gravitate to a table that sounds good to them, and they play just for 3 hours, and then it ends. And the next week we do it again. Or I guess actually the next day, if we do it both Monday and Tuesday. But does that make sense in terms of the structure?
Yeah.
That I think I haven't been to another event like it. Usually I think they're a little more structured than that, but I love the looseness of it, that it leads to so much creativity. And I think it's really important to be experimental when you're trying to find a game or a table or a group of people that works for you. That I tend to, or I've in the past, like locked into a game too soon before I knew that I wasn't going to like it. And then it's super awkward to get out. I really recommend that people test out tables. And that's why I think one shots, you need to do those before you actually commit to play a game for any amount of time. Like, don't get too married to your character or to your table, your DM, and other people, because you don't know whether it's going to mesh and you don't want to feel compelled to stick around if it's not working for you. So I like starting with one shots, opening with one shots, and they can lead to longer term like connections and a longer term campaign. But I think you have to start with something small and low commitment.
Has any of your
And
game have any of those games burst into, have they
yeah, they
gone
have.
further?
Yeah, several. In fact, I mean, then really cool ones. I guess I could go into, I don't need to go into the details in some of them, but the Skyrim dwarf game, it became a campaign, and one of the people, he ran a very silly like space pirate. So it's D&D 5th edition, but it's in space. So if you're a druid, your character is like some sort of genetic engineer who like can encourage plant growth. And he did this one shot several times with a lot of different groups where they had to like break onto a ship and steal a load of like fuel, and it was so po it was very popular. He ran it over and over again, and eventually a group liked it so much that they turned it into a full-fledged campaign. So we've had many of our one shots kind of give birth to those, and it kind of evolve into something more. I just think it's really good because initially, when we first started, I kind of just assigned people to tables, or we formed groups because we thought a campaign is what we had to do. And then we had a lot of really unhappy players and DMs that they didn't mesh as well as I thought they would, that you really have to spend time to find the right place for you, that you can't just jump into the first thing that's available, that it's better to feel it out, I think. Anyway, that was what I learned by running this event.
Is this all free, or is there like cover charge?
Oh, no,
or something?
It's all free.
Okay.
Yeah. I think it's at a bar, so like people buy drinks. I mean, I don't need to like pitch it because I'm sure most people are not. If you're in Atlanta, then we are at Joystick Game Bar. And if you buy $15 worth of food and drinks, you actually get a free drink for your DM. We give out little tokens. So it's a really fun event, but it's completely free for all players. They just buy food and drinks, and that's why the bar lets us do it.
I mean, yeah, they're people will stay there for at least 3 hours drinking.
Yeah.
And being – have. But you are one of the DMs running the one-shots?
Well, let's see. Yes, I run the event, and then I also DM one-shots.
Okay, so you're doing double duty, basically?
I think lately, now that we have enough DMs, I choose to just focus on running the event in case there's a fire or some question that arises. I prefer to keep myself free to run the event, but if there are not enough other DMs. But lately, since we started giving out free drinks, all of a sudden – now, like, I think we have a surplus of DMs now, which
all of a sudden,
yeah, I don't know what
strange, you know, coincidence
does equal causation. It is. It's weird. I don't know, but it's been really good. That's why I love the model, which I feel like I'm talking too much about my event. I do love the event, but I think that I'm pleased that it seems to be self-sustaining, because a lot of other D&D events, they fizzle because maybe they don't have enough game runners. And I think the way that we're structuring this, we tend to have more than enough game runners, and they're even competing with each other. They want to out DM, and it's made me a better DM that we've brought in so many good DMs, really, really talented folks. And I see the games they run. I think that's actually the thing I'm most pleased about, that having a community of dungeon masters is unreal. Like, I've never been part of a community of DMs before and connected with people and like shared war stories or like talked about different shared resources, that I'm learning a lot from these other people and seeing the games they run, playing in their games when I'm not running my own. That it really improves me. I feel like, I don't know, I think that was interesting, that when we started, people were a little more competitive and a little more anxious, and like they were afraid they weren't good enough as a DM and they didn't want to get shown up. And over time, I think people have loosened up about it. And now we realize like we all just love this hobby and we love storytelling and we're all on the same page and we're not judging each other. And so I don't know if there's things like that in other cities, but it really was a little transformative for me. And I think nothing has made me so much better at DMing so much faster, that I'm able to see what I'm not doing right, and I'm able to see what other people are doing that I love and I want to incorporate it into my game. So it's more useful than I thought it was going to be. Like, it's made a bigger impact than I thought it would.
Do you have any, like, I think my biggest fear that, like, running just a open meetup D&D, anyone can show up, people who are just randomly there will play. Are you, like, do you ever run into, like, problem players, people who aren't, I don't know, you know, there's lots of kinds of problem players, but you know,
no, you're right. But I mean, also, yeah, at our event, like, there's alcohol too, so I think that it can even exacerbate those sorts of things. But I think, yeah, everyone has horror stories from conventions and bad experiences of people being like really weird and creepy. I think I feel like we've been quite lucky. I can only think of a few instances where it's happened, but I do think that having really clear ground rules. And I think this can apply to people running a home game too, because I think my worst experiences have been at home games when people ended up being like a little weirder than I thought, or like they went a direction I didn't expect them to. Even like good friends of mine, that it's something just weird comes out in one session and you don't really know how to deal with it. So I think session zeros and like having a clear plan for what to do if people's boundaries are crossed or something uncomfortable happens. That at conventions, they have what's called an X card. Have you heard of this?
Yeah, yeah. I've heard of the X card.
Okay.
Which it's a very good idea. It's a very good.
It is. It's a very good idea. And I think especially for an event like this with strangers, that having something that is clearly there, like it's a card that has an X on one side of it, and you flip the card over to reveal the X if someone's crossed. Like, it's not about being judgmental. You don't even have to say who did what. You basically just flip the X, and it means we're taking a break. And then if you can address the problem with the DM outside of the game, but you basically step away. But it means that like someone is not feeling comfortable and they want to break, is all the X card means. And I know that the thing is, like, nothing is a perfect solution, that this is a really bad problem. I think we've been very lucky. But then what we do, there's staff at the bar and then those of us volunteers who run the event, that I think people know they can come to us, and we basically try to make it clear that we want this to be a safe and inclusive space. Come speak to us if there's ever a problem. And then we observe the tables, and all of our DMs also like kind of know that's the rule, and they try to moderate or mediate that it is part of the role of the DM, though, that if something is really weird and uncomfortable, that you kind of do have to step in, and that if you want the players to be the ones to handle that, it's good to let them know, which is why a session zero is so important. Before you even start the campaign, you want to get ground rules down that say, like, these are the kind of things that are off the table. Like, please don't. Because a good friend of mine, he runs games, but he says that, like, he doesn't want any dogs to be harmed in his games. Like, he never has dogs as enemies, and, like, he doesn't want any PC to harm a dog. Like, that's just a rule for him. So he makes it clear at the beginning that, like, he doesn't, like, that's not cool. Like, that never happens in his game. That's, like, a simple example. But he's just very clear and upfront about it. And if it ever happened, I think he would just basically step in and say that that made him uncomfortable. I don't know that that's really answered the question well. The point is, it's a very insidious and difficult problem, but I think open and clear communication and DMs being responsive to that feedback and not feeling defensive and, like, actually dealing with the problem directly, those are the only two ways to deal with it, I think, is the DM taking responsibility, having something clear that's in place that everyone knows, like, what the rule is, and maybe to the degree to which they're comfortable, having the players also help. Make it a comfortable and safe space. And if there's anyone who's, like, running the larger event, if it's not a home game, making sure they're on board too, and that they actually have a system or rules in place.
You answered my question, Brad. You're fine.
Okay,
you're,
nice.
Perfect. You're doing
it's just,
okay.
It's a big issue, and I feel strongly about it. I don't mean to toot our horn too much. I do feel like we have been quite successful with our event, which it leads me to something else that I find interesting. That because you were talking about how. Different other settings is like it's brought people who are not the traditional D&D players maybe into the hobby. Wizards did a survey recently, and they found that 40% of D&D players are women. I think some people were questioning the validity of the survey method. So that being what it may, but our event, it seems to kind of bear that out, though, that we actually have a lot of women that come to our event. It's not a male-dominated thing. And that makes it very different from maybe like not all Adventures League games, but I kind of wanted to get into that. Do you know what Adventures League is, Robbie?
Yeah, it's more of a like a sanctioned kind of like the same kind of general idea of like let's get people's feet wet and give them a chance to try D&D. Let's say people don't have a DM.
Yeah.
This is a way to introduce them to the hobby and get them, but it's sanctioned by Wizards.
And they have rewards, too, that you play a certain number of games. You can kind of get in-game rewards for it, and you keep track of your characters and your XP and everything. So it's like, if you wanted more bookkeeping, if you're like, D&D's good, but if there was just like more stuff to keep track of,
more spreadsheets. I need more spreadsheets, please.
I do love a good spreadsheet, personally.
But... I'm also a fan at times. I would also add that Paizo and Pathfinder also have a similar...
Oh, yeah. That's similar true. Yeah, I think that they might have... I think they had it earlier. I think Pathfinder Society probably predated Adventures League.
Yeah.
Maybe not, because I think Adventures League is a 5th edition thing. I don't think they had a 4th E. Maybe they did.
Pathfinders has... It feels like... there was a trajectory, feels like, where D&D hit 4th edition and struggled trying to find its identity for a long time. And then eventually 5E... Then they realized how poorly they were doing it. I think Pathfinder took that... opportunity and, you know, did very well and like introduced a lot of interesting ideas. But now it seems like, I don't know, just this is my like outsider's perspective because I don't play Pathfinder. But it seems like 5e has kind of overtaken it by stealing a lot of those ideas and then just implementing them with a larger focus.
I think you're okay. I think I'm not going to disagree because you're exactly right. At the same time, Pathfinder was also basically D&D 3.5. Yes. So they borrow heavily from one another. It's like Warcraft and Warhammer. I guess people might not have known that, but like Warhammer, the original like Warcraft, Blizzard wanted to make a Warhammer game, but they got turned down. So they basically just stole like a lot of the stuff from it and then made. So StarCraft is basically Warhammer 40K and whatever. It's the same thing. Like they borrow back and forth. Maybe that wasn't a very good analogy. Cause I don't know that Warhammer's taken anything from Warcraft, but whatever, you know what I mean?
I mean, lately they've certainly, they I don't know. I don't follow Warhammer hobby very closely. I know Warhammer has had a drastic change in how it's structured. 40K I think has largely stayed the same, but Warhammer Fantasy has,
they rebooted, I know.
Yeah, they rebooted.
They destroyed the old world.
And changed the whole, like, it's more skirmish-based, I think. I'm sure there's still people who build gigantic armies, but my impression was that it was smaller focus because probably people weren't going to buy the $7 million models. There really is many of them.
Although at this point, we've chosen to talk about something that neither of us really knows anything about. So
I played Warhammer when I was 13 years old.
I literally never have. I think that, but I still, there was something I wanted to say because we were talking about.
Okay.
I feel like I opened up a can of worms a little bit. I have a
tendency. How dare you introduce Warhammer discussion here? Let me make a quick joke on Warhammer's expense, Brad, and then you can finish your thought.
Go on.
My quick joke on Warhammer's expense is if you love Warhammer, if you love yelling at another dude about a ruler. Do you like yelling about rulers on a piece of like green board?
It doesn't.
Okay, then that's my joke about Warhammer.
Yeah, it's all about, yeah, then I need to get on this then. I mean, I never knew what I was missing.
That's if you're playing with cool people, that never comes up. But you know, there are definitely that Warhammer attracts. Just like tabletop attracts certain, also can attract certain kind of toxic personalities. Finish
that's
your thought.
What I talk about. Okay. No, I mean that's actually the segues, because that's what I wanted to get, because I feel like I started to say something that was actually a bit controversial and I didn't get to finish my not that you interrupted me, but like I didn't finish my thoughts, not that I didn't get to.
What was
but
it?
That I wanted to finish it because I started talking a little bit of smack about Adventurers League and I said something that was a little insulting towards AL, and I feel like I didn't actually finish the thought the way that I should have. And that's kind of so I wanted to talk about the difference between people that play Adventures League and the people that have maybe been brought into the hobby recently through things like Critical Role. That a friend of mine, she runs the AL events actually here in Atlanta, but she posted a Venn diagram of those two different groups. And the joke, I guess, was that they didn't touch. So the people that are coming into the hobby via Critical Role that are like, they see it and they're like, they think it's all about acting and role play. And then the Adventures League players who, at least in my experience, I'm casting a wide net here, but we have people that are into Adventures League who come to our event, and they tend to be a lot more by the book. Like, they know the rules inside and out, and I don't know, like, some of them are rules lawyers, but some of them, they just really, really love the combat, and they love the strategy. But the point is, like, those are two completely different things. In D&D, the strategy and the role play are part of the same game, but it's not always, people are not always interested in both. And that it seems like AL leans a little heavily because it's so bookkeeping centric. And it is like, I want D&D, but I don't already know, I don't already know anybody, one. And two, I want more bookkeeping. I want to keep track of stuff and get these rewards. That attracts a different sort of person who, like, they have trouble getting a friend group together, maybe, but they also are super into keeping track of stuff. That it's a very different crowd than the people who watch Critical Role who think that it's all about acting, it's all about role play, and like that's the emphasis. And I think the reason I mention it isn't to knock AL, because I think it's a great way into the hobby, and I think that the strategy component of D&D is something I really love. But what I mean is, when people watch Crit Role and then their first experience is going to an AL event, they don't know what the hell they've gotten into, because they watch Crit Role and it's like all these good looking actors being really funny and like improvising, and then they go to an Adventures League game and it's like a lot of math. And I think they tend to be a little turned off from the hobby. Not everybody, but I think some people, it doesn't end up being what they expected. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think that is a larger contextual discussion about what D&D is and how it's a thing that it's a very simple, easy way to know what, like, when you're reading the rules of a tabletop system, of an RPG system, it's very easy to know how, like, if you want to know what the game is about, you know, mm-hmm. at least from a strict, I'm reading this on this rule book, I am not just making up rules, which everyone does.
Yeah.
You look at what are the rules about? You know, if you need to know what this game is about, like, what are most of the rules? What are they rules for? What are they, like, how, what, when do I roll a die? You know,
it makes sense. I think that in the problem, though, is I think that is what people come into D&D thinking, that, like, they get the book. So Matt Coville has a really good YouTube video that I highly recommend called "The Map Is Not the Territory," where he basically spells this out, and he says that it's just the same way that a screenplay is not a movie, and a recipe written down on a card is not a tasty dish you would want to eat, that the D&D rulebook is not D&D at all. People get it and they think, like, this is D&D. Once I know these rules, I can D&D. And I think that's missing the point, in my opinion, that it's more about the experience you're having there. The rules are really just a way to facilitate that and to get everyone on the same page and, like, help it go smoothly. But in my opinion, obviously, I mean, I talk about the importance of improv. I run rules light games. I know the rules quite well because I've been DMing for like so many years, but I think that if the rules get in the way of your fun, and in fact, the Dungeon Master's Guide kind of says this, if the rules are getting in the way of your fun, you jettison the rules, that they shouldn't inhibit your fun. They're meant to facilitate it. And I think that's where I think people go awry. But I guess that I think that AL games are really great. And I think that wanting it to be like a hard strat, like a not hard, what I mean is a serious
Tactical.
strategy game, a tactical game, that's great. And I think that I just want there to be a place where people who see, oh, this is what I want. This is beautiful and great. I want this in my life. And then I just don't want them to be turned off by anything. Like whether it's AL or a home game they go to, I want people to find the game that's right for them and to feel like it's what they expected and to love the hobby as much as I do. And I think that's why I was knocking on AL a little bit, because I feel like people a little sometimes are surprised. Doesn't end up being what they expect. But I think it comes down to not having a session zero and not being clear about what people's expectations are for the game. And if what they want is Matt Mercer, that maybe just being upfront, like I don't do a very role play heavy game. Matt Koval also has a really nice idea for a pitch document. If you look Google like Matthew Koval's pitch document, we use that for our
That's
games.
very,
Where
I really,
have you seen it?
I've seen the one where he, is it the, I don't know if it's the same one I'm thinking of. It's the one where like he actually had like four different,
Yes,
he had
there's
like
tactics,
three
role play.
metrics. Yeah. The three
Yep,
metrics
exactly.
and like
So it's
heavy, light,
tactics,
medium.
tactics, role play. Exactly. And it's perfect. Because then, if what you want to do is the traditional dungeon crawl where it's like all about kicking down a door and fighting a monster, then it's high tactics, low role play, and maybe low or medium. The third one is
Politics,
politics, which also can mean like lore of the world and like how much you need to know that. So it kind of depends, but that. Some people want like a really lore heavy game. They want to just deal with political intrigue and they're fine with there never being a combat encounter. And I think that just giving people those three metrics, those three different dimensions of your game, it can do a lot to make sure that you're on the same page. And like a one sentence or two sentence synopsis. So we do that for all our campaigns, that we require every DM to give us just maybe one or two sentence brief synopsis, rate it on these three dimensions. And I also have them give me keywords. So if it's like horror, or if it's maybe very psychological. I mentioned these are the games I run. I run dark, like psychological games that kind of mess with the players. And that's not everyone's speed. I don't want someone to show up at my game. And it's happened that I run a game for them. Oh gosh, it was the windmill scene actually from Curse of Strahd. I ran some poor newbies through it and it felt like just a meat grinder. Like they didn't know how the combat worked. They were miserable. Like it was so above their level and it was just rough. And that I think to avoid situations like that, I want to give people a heads up before we run a game. And like, this is what my focus is. Like, I really want, tactics or like high combat. It's going to be dark and psychological. It's going to be like Silent Hill, that things are going to be maybe a little like twisted and messed up. Like, they need to know that coming in. Or if what you want is like a high fantasy romp, because a lot of that was actually the feedback I got from you and Jessica after Curse of Strahd. You're like, can we just do just Lord of the Rings-esque like high fantasy, please? Because it's what people think of for D&D. I love writing horror, but I think it's good to give the players what they want, or at least to know that you match. If all I want to run is horror and all you guys want is Lord of the Rings high fantasy, that's fine, but we need to know what each other wants. Because if I'm miserable running this game, or if you're miserable playing my game, then we need to know that straight away, and we need to not go down that road. So that's really my emphasis, I guess, that's something that's been on my mind a lot running these events. Like, you want to enhance comfort. You want to enhance the quality of people's match with their table. And I think that using Matt Koval's pitch document is a great way to do that. I think just kind of meeting people where they are. And then also being willing to try new things, both by improving and just following the players where they go as opposed to railroading, but also do one shots before you settle on anything. Like try different styles of games, try post-apocalyptic 1 week, and then try a sci-fi adventure another week. And then traditional high fantasy another week, and a horror game the fourth. Like try all the different styles until the group decides like this is we love this, like this is better than we thought. We didn't know we'd like a horror game, but we love it and we want to do it. So one shots are a great way.
I can't shut you up, Brad. You have
I'm
so many
sorry.
words. No, that's fine. No, it's good. That's usually the opposite.
I just I love
I usually have the
I
opposite
have taught
problem.
college. I'm sorry. I taught college and I love the sound of my voice. So I could just talk and talk and talk. I only did lectures. There was never any interaction. It was just me talking. And yet my rate of professor is actually quite high. So
Not to blow your
people
own horn or anything.
I think earlier, yeah, I said I don't like to toot my own horn and then consistently just have been blowing it just the whole
No,
time. So, sorry.
it's good. I'm I I I all that advice is very good. The Matt Colville YouTube channel, he's terrific.
Highly recommend it.
Terrific. Yeah, even if you don't even run D&D, like there are some of his videos that are specific. Yeah, a lot of it is specific to D&D, but a lot of them are also like how to adapt, how to build things, how to deal with players, how ethos about running.
Yeah.
How about running games and DMing. Like, it's very helpful.
I agree.
Help build confidence in someone if you don't know what you're doing. And speaking of someone who doesn't know what they're doing.
Yeah. Good segue.
Well, it's, again, not a podcast unless you point out your segues. I wanted to ask your thoughts on now that, because this is the first time that you, I mean, I've ran one shots for you a couple times before.
Yeah.
But this is, you're in my Call of Cthulhu campaign, which is decidedly not D&D. So different than D&D. How many games do you play in? Just one or a few others?
Two? I think yours and one other.
Is it the other one to D&D?
It is. No, it's not anymore. This is a little bit of a digression, but because you asked, the other game is one I've played in for maybe 12 years. I'm actually playing the same character that I played. I think I mentioned earlier, like playing in a paladin in a group of murder hobos that still play that paladin from over a decade ago. And we went from like level 3 all the way to 20 and then epic. And so we're doing this like superhero Silver Surfer-esque, like flying through space, punching Galactus sort of thing.
Cosmic.
We call it our cosmic campaign, but that's sort of the level. But anyway, it's, so that's fun. But those are the two games I play in, is this one that I've been playing in for like a lifetime, and then the Call of Cthulhu game as well.
I mean, no pressure. I mean, you're speaking directly to me and being recorded about, you know, how you feel about something.
I don't feel any pressure. I don't feel any at all.
Okay, good. From a player's perspective.
Yeah.
What's the difference? How do you feel about playing in Call of Cthulhu versus, you know, you're very comfortable in D&D. How does it feel playing in that game and your impressions of me running the game for you?
I think you have done a fantastic job. I think that, and it's just my perspective, I wonder, like, it feels almost, because it's a horror game, and it feels almost like how in classic, like, PlayStation horror games, the controls were, like, real bad, and it added to the horror element of it, because something would happen, and you're like, oh, God, I don't even know what to do. How do I turn and shoot at it? That's how Call of Cthulhu feels to me, that I do not like the mechanics of it. Like, I still don't get them. And we've been playing it for a long time. It's not that bad. It just seems very convoluted. And maybe it's just because I've been playing D&D for half my life that it seems like second nature to me. But the actual mechanics of Call of Cthulhu, it's not my personal favorite. But I do think that, I guess the benefit of it is that because the mechanics are so odd, that I feel like they don't come up much in our game, and that's what I love about it, that it really is a lot of good character interaction between our players, or between the player characters. And I really love that. I love our dynamic, and I feel like that's when any tabletop RPG works well, is when you have a lot of crosstalk at the table that is in character. I think that means you're succeeding as a DM, and I feel like you've done a really good job of that. I feel like we've had a lot of really good in-character interactions. I really have a good feel for the other characters too.
I think it's only three players, so it is it's tight group. You guys are all very good, and you're fun. You are, I think, pretty consistent with who your characters are, which I think is, I don't know. It is a horror game, and the rules of Call of Cthulhu are interesting. I wouldn't call them bad. I would call them weird. And I think they have this, like, they're in their 7th edition, and like, they've been around for a long time. And it largely, like, despite the fact that they're in 7th edition, the rules haven't changed that much.
Yeah.
And I think it is, like, if there's a lot of other Cthulhu style tabletop games now, like, if you want to play a Cthulhu, you know, horror game, Eldritch horror, whatever, there's plenty of different alternatives. I just I don't know if it was, it's interesting dipping my toes in there. And that's my first, I had a very abbreviated run as a DM for a D&D game, and I failed miserably. This has been much more successful. And I think largely because I have embraced less planning. Although I do plan.
I'm glad it works. Because I feel like you started this after we had that conversation. Do you remember?
Yeah, Lazy DM. And that's a great book. And I kickstarted. They made just the sequel was just kickstarted. And I kickstarted that. I'm looking forward to that a lot. And I think I'm running a sandbox world in this Call of Cthulhu game. So it is not. I'm not running off a module, even though I've kind of built a module for myself, largely. Like, it is very much like, here's a setting, here's NPCs, and I would like it using those metrics. It is very, it's politics heavy, and basically like combat tactics extraordinarily light, and like role play medium to heavy, depending, I think, on the
depends on the session.
But it largely it is because I've let go of worrying about where the table is in this room. They're gonna go to this mansion. How is the mansion laid out? That doesn't really,
I think that it helps
matter
a lot to let go of that stuff, though. I feel like it's liberating, and I think that it, because it doesn't contribute as much to the player's experience as you might think. I think that it makes you feel a little more comfortable, maybe, but then as soon as they deviate from like your carefully constructed path, then you feel uncomfortable again, and your desire will be to pull them back onto your railroad path, which is why that only by like getting comfortable with improving almost everything, then you can learn to kind of build that confidence and trust in yourself to come up with the details on the fly, and you get better at that because you have to be ready for it when they go off the rails, unless you want to hold them to those rails. And I think no one likes that. It doesn't make for a good game at D&D.
I think there are some people who are totally fine with, like, as long as the story is well written, I think that's the problem. Most people are bad writers. So
yeah,
if you're railroading people and the story's amazing and they are bought in on that story, then I'm sure people, like some people, are like, I didn't even know I was on railroads because I was just experiencing the story and loving it the whole time. But a lot of people, like you said earlier, it is about finding the game that is right for you. And some people,
that's true,
don't mind that, but largely, like, I want, you know, I would like to be able to do whatever I want and have a loose framework of.
I think you're right, too, that, and also I think that I maybe make a mistake in always trying to make a sandbox game because it's what I like to run. But I think, as I mentioned before, that like I ran a game for people that were very new to the game. People who've never played D&D before, they can be overwhelmed by the number of options, you know, that. Have you seen The Hurt Locker, the scene where he like goes and is in the cereal aisle at the supermarket and it's just like you are like paralyzed with all the different choices? That I think that's how it can feel like to be a new player at D&D or any tabletop RPG, and you're just plopped in this world and you're like, you can go anywhere. There's like the Swamp of Sadness over here and the Mountains of Madness over there. And like it's too much. Like you're looking for the hook. You're looking for like, where's the quest giver with the exclamation point over their head? Like, what do I do? And it takes a while for people to like sink into it and get more comfortable sandboxing it. I think it's better to start with something more linear.
I prefer, especially
for new players.
I agree with you 100%, except I prefer the Mr. Burns in the cereal aisle looking for the cereal box that has his face on it. Like Krusty. Oh, Krusty has his box. So he goes to Count Chocula because it's close enough. But
nice.
Ketchup? Catsup. It is, there's a wide variety of players, and there's some people who want their handheld a little bit, you know, they don't,
And there's nothing wrong with that.
No, there is nothing wrong with that. You know, it is finding the right fit, as you said before.
And I think it is a bit of an art. I think I've been learning how to fit people with other DMs that match them. I mean, that's different. I mean, not everyone's gonna be running an event like I do. Like, you have to learn the different DM styles, but I think really just like being upfront and communicating. And so a good session zero, and there are guides online for like how to have a good session zero. But I think letting people know using Matt Coville's metrics, kind of how your game compares, and maybe even offering them a few choices. Like, here's the games I'd be interested in running. Like, I would be down to do this, you know, vampire panty raid, or I can do this mind delving thing, like in a space station. And like you just offer different things you want to do, and then they can decide, like, this one sounds interesting to us, let's try it. Start it as a one shot, low commitment, and then if they like it, you can continue. And I think too, I was surprised by how unwilling people are to quit a game once they get going, that the inertia of a game carries them, even if they're not happy and they would be way happier at another table or doing a different game, they still won't quit. It's really hard to quit a game once it's going, I think. People are a little more timid about that than I thought.
I mean, the thought came to me and I was going to ask you, like, I subscribe to like 5 different RPG subreddits, and the, like, besides, I guess, Art of Characters, which seems to be very popular.
Which, understandable.
Yeah, that's fine. That's totally cool with me. The other thing is people complaining about a problem in their group. And overwhelmingly, people aren't coming. Usually, these problems aren't small things either. It is not like, oh, this one guy is a little annoying with this character. It is usually some glaring bright red siren that I'd be like, that's terrible. You should. And like all the answers are immediately like, don't play with those people. Why are you still playing with them? Stop. Go find someone else.
I wonder. I think that people don't feel, I guess it's a few things, because I was about to say, like, well, maybe, you know, I'm just spoiled because I'm in the big city and like Atlanta, I got so many options. But then I see it here, like I'm running this event and like the people at this table, like they stick with the table they're unhappy with. I'm like, there's another table right there. Like, I don't even have to turn my head. There's another table with other people at it in my field of vision, and you won't switch. I think it's that it's uncomfortable to break up with a table. It's uncomfortable to break up with your DM, that you feel like they're going to be insulted. And I think that, and actually, come to think of it, like, I'm not to undermine my own point, but just being realistic, that one of our players, that he's even like one of the more brusque and direct and blunt people that I know. And he was the only person who was willing to take my advice and actually leave a table he didn't like. But it did create bad blood. Like, it actually, his DM was like a little awkward about it. He was a little awkward with them. That table eventually broke up. Partly because, so the thing is, like, it is like an awkward thing for everyone around. So I think I'm making it sound more doom and gloom than I meant to. But the point is, the only way to keep that from happening, that it can be awkward if a good friend of yours is running the game, and you know it's going to hurt their feelings for you to leave, and it might actually like damage your friendship. I think that's why session zero is so effing important. Make sure, like, please don't commit to a game until you know, like, do whatever you can to slow down the start of a game, that try to convince them if someone's like, hey, let's do this campaign, like really push them to run it as a one shot. Like, just hesitate before you ever commit to a campaign, because I'm still in a campaign that I've been in for over a decade. And honestly, I don't know how to get out at this point. Like, I don't know how I would let the DM know I don't want to play anymore, because I know it would hurt them. And that's just the truth, that I can be pretty blunt and direct when I need to be, but this is hard. And that's why it's so important to be really careful when you join a campaign, because it is a commitment.
There's a rule that repeats it. It's no D&D is better than bad D&D.
Correct. Yeah, it is better to not play at all. But I think that maybe they're missing the point, because on Reddit too, isn't like on our relationships, the advice is always break up with them. Like, people kind of, like when it's not me doing the breaking up, like, I'm, it's like, yeah, that's easier. The easiest thing. Yeah, breakups are super easy. They don't cause any pain.
Like, I mean,
breakups are really painful.
Maybe I am just kind of the point where I don't take it too personally when, if someone said to me, I can't play anymore for this, whatever reason, I'd be like, all right, it's okay. I'll survive.
I think that, well, let's see, on Reddit, that when you're on the other side of a screen, it is easier to say that you imagine it'll be easier than it is. And I think that, cause I felt the same way. Like, we do this DM pitch at our events on Monday and Tuesday. And I remember the first week when I was like, you know what, we should not limit the number of people that can pitch. Let's have all 7 DMs pitch, even though we only have enough players for 5 tables. And then some of the other DMs are like, yeah, I won't have my feelings hurt if I don't get any players. It'll be fine. And then we had them pitch and they didn't get any players. And then later they come up to me and were like, yeah, that actually hurt my feelings quite a bit. Like, I said it wouldn't hurt my feelings, and it totally did. I think that we underestimate sometimes how much people might be harmed, but it depends on the group. I think some DMs you can say like, hey, I can't play anymore. Cause I told a friend of mine here, I was like, hey, I don't have time for this. Like, I'm already running several games and playing in 3 others. Like, I don't have time. And he was totally cool with it. And then other DMs, like I've tried to get out of their games and they kind of pulled me back in, that they were a little more needy. So it really depends on the person, but I do agree with you, Robbie, that it's better to get out if you can. No D&D is better than bad D&D. And it's just about, I guess, being tough and like actually just allowing yourself to hurt these people's feelings and just deal with the consequences.
I say it only because some of those situations proposed are unbelievably toxic.
Yeah, they're ludicrous.
It's not,
that's true.
And that's the thing I want to, like, I don't know if some people don't recognize the toxicity in these their own groups. So like notes about like, I'm the only female player and another player is constantly trying to rape my PC. I'm like, dear, run away.
Yeah, you need to not see these people anymore.
Don't talk to these people. They're bad.
Delete their numbers from the phone. Yeah.
I'm like, I don't know if you realize that's emblematic of them as people, but it kind of is. So they should probably, you should go not play games with them.
But
because
that's a reason for a session zero, because that's something that should be hashed out at a session zero. You should know, like, this is off the table. Please don't do this.
No.
If there are ground rules established, then you can add another one later. If something happens that you didn't know it was going to bother you, you're like, okay, this, like, constantly maybe harassing or flirting with my character or whatever, that I don't like it. Let's add it the ground rule. I don't want that from now on. But I think that I'm basically talking about a lot of preparation and a lot of prevention through preparation, that joining a D&D campaign or running a D&D campaign is a commitment unless it's a one shot, which is why I highly recommend one shots as a way to test the waters. So a one shot is low commitment. You can figure out some of these problems before they arise. But if you do a campaign, if you commit to a campaign, you need to go in with an understanding that you may have to quit, that you need to be ready. You should not join a campaign if you can't tell the DM to their face that you have to quit. That's a little bit extreme, but that's why people get into these situations like the ones, and not that it's their fault, I'm not trying to blame the victim, but I am saying that they are stuck in a D&D game they can't get out of, but it's because they joined it and they committed to it and they don't feel comfortable to tell the DM that they're leaving. They don't feel comfortable enough to walk away. That's dangerous, that you need to make sure you're okay with that before you start, in case in the off chance something like that arises. You have to be able to kind of flip that switch and get out.
Hit the eject button.
I was going to say pull the trigger, but then that was like a violent metaphor, so I chose to flip the switch. It seemed a little better. Eject button, yeah, that's good.
Hit that button.
Yeah, just got to hit it.
Just like on YouTube.
I think that's the best advice I can give for that particular thing, that I see a lot of people who get in over their heads. They get stuck in games they don't like. And I think just before you start a game, try and have the ground rules clear for everyone. Make sure it's a good fit. But then also know that if it isn't, that you can walk away. Like, you need to be mentally ready to do that before you join. If you can't say that, if you can't say, like, yes, I could tell the DM that I don't want to play anymore, then it's more dangerous. And you need to be aware that you're risking something by getting into a game that you're not willing to walk away from, because then you're trapped.
I mean, you just don't show up. Just don't show up, or don't, you know.
Or, yeah, the thing is, okay, I think maybe where I've gone too far is by saying,
I would totally say ghost them. Like, that is a completely optional. That's like on the table. You can just ghost people.
And it's easier with Roll20 or with a game where, you know, you're not friends with them. Otherwise, you can just not show up, stop responding to texts. And I've had people ghost me as a DM that I would rather them have told me. Actually, I wasn't offended that they didn't come back. I was offended that we kept like expecting them or waiting on them. Or there were times when they said they would come and then just didn't show up. Like, that's why I would prefer players of mine just to tell me, like, actually, we hate your DM style. We hate your face. We hate your stupid face. And then just
your stupid,
that would be easy,
ugly,
to me.
Dumb face.
Yeah, exactly. I would rather them just text me that or like post that on my Facebook wall or whatever. And then I know to not like put out hors d'oeuvres for them. Like, then I know that it's clear they're not going to be showing up.
Don't.
It's much easier.
I prepared little pieces of baby carrots and broccoli with
ranch. Because that's the problem. Because then that's going to go bad. Because I don't eat that shit. Like, vegetables. It's gross. So
what?
That's the point.
What's wrong with broccoli?
I like broccoli. Actually, I didn't mean to be ragging on broccoli so much.
I know.
It was unkind of me.
Broccoli's good. It's crunchy.
Well, unless it's cooked.
Not as much. It's fine. Then you cover it in cheese.
Yeah, that's true.
Butter and cheese.
That sounds delicious. I haven't actually had dinner yet. I need to.
You're 2 hours behind me. I'm a little surprised you haven't eaten yet.
I had a busy day at the Ren Faire.
Did you have any turkey legs?
No, I didn't. I didn't eat any Ren Faire food.
Oh,
which was
no turkey legs?
I know, right? I don't know what I was thinking, actually.
That's like, that's the only time you get to do
that.
That's
a good point. And that was like the thing I was most, I have no idea why I made the choices I made. I have no explanation. It's completely inexplicable, even to me. I don't know why I did that. I think it was just because I had beers and that, like,
that'll do it.
I didn't want to have both, but I also didn't want to at any point not have a beer. And so I think that was the rub. I think that's how, that's why it went down this way.
Just like Shakespeare said.
Yeah, it's true.
He, that famous play wrote about beers and turkey legs at Renaissance fairs.
And how you can't have both at the same time.
Aye, that's the rub.
Yeah.
That Shakespeare, no. he was a smart guy.
He, yeah, was prophetic, and he knew.
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
I think that's all I got.
Okay. Yeah, I don't, like, I'm trying to think of other, like, I could bring up a lot more things, and we could talk for a lot longer, I'm sure, about stuff, but there is, a reasonable length of time spoken about one topic before people,
yeah,
you know, you learn better. You understand better with small bite-sized chunks of information rather than,
I agree,
3 hours of lecture.
Well, I think that then, well, maybe we can summarize then.
Summarize.
What so, it so, is so, that so, we...
I think ultimately, like, the is DMing is, like, if I think if our first was be a lazy DM and don't plan,
yeah,
over, don't overplan. Two is, I think, set proper expectations with your players.
I think that that's where prep should go, and I think that that's what's interesting to me. I think that DMs are willing to put so much prep into their world, the lore, the monsters, all the math, and like the maps and everything. And I think that's good. It's good to do that if you want to, but I think that you can run a better game by maybe chucking all that and just like really getting good at improv. The maps maybe are icing on the cake, but you need like a strong core of improv. But then I think a place where you really should do preparation, because it's preventative of problems down the line. And it's weird that I don't see people do this as much, but where you should prep is like actually making sure that you know the people that are going to be in your game well, or that you know that their expectations are the same as what you want to run, that everyone's on the same page. Like that's it, I guess it's conversation. It's not something that can be done independently. And that's why DMs might focus on world building and lore, because it's something you can do privately. But D&D is a collaborative game. I think it needs to be done more through communication and conversation, getting people on the same page, even if you don't want to do that, just follow some of Matt Koval's advice and like provide them information about what the game's going to be like. Don't throw too much at them. Keep it to a few sentences and the metrics he provides. And maybe I do some keywords that kind of give them the flavor of what you can do, or like what are the different kinds of games you want to run. But I think an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, is the expression. I think that you want to head off any potential problems of like mismatch between you and the players and their expectations. You want to set everything up in advance. It'll pay dividends down the line. It'll make sure they enjoy the game long term if everyone knows what everyone else is there for, and it'll make sure you get a good match with players at the table.
Yeah.
That less preparation in terms of each session, more preparation in terms of the campaign. Be careful about campaigns. One shots are a great way to kind of test the waters. So I highly recommend that.
Yeah. Yes. Talk to your players. Ask them what they want. Yeah. Tell them what you want. Communicate.
Yeah. Because D&D is a game of communication. I think it's one of the few, I think that, I mean, you can communicate in a lot of online games we play, but like, that's not central to it. You can be completely silent and play those, but D&D is all about interpersonal interactions, you know, face to face, that when you're starting the game, before you start the game, you need to get that going right away and make sure there's chemistry, basically.
Right. It's like
you should take that more seriously.
It's like speed dating.
Yeah. That's what one shots are like, speed dating, which is why I think one shots at our event, they're so central to it, because they help set things up for campaigns later. That we added that as a requirement, that you must play in one shots your first few sessions, at least two, before you can even be accepted into a campaign. That we don't allow people into campaigns unless they've been in a few one shots, and because we want to get to know them. And people like the one shots too, that they, some people like never want to join a campaign. They just want to keep doing one shots every week because it's always new.
It's a certain charm.
I highly recommend. Yeah, I agree. It's not as much for me. I prefer campaigns personally, but I do think that one shots are necessary to set things up.
I think it's, we didn't get into this because I think it would take another half hour of discussion, but I am a system slut to.
So yeah, you like, you like testing out different systems.
I like seeing, I like trying different things. So that would, yeah, that would be a lovely way to be able to do that. It's just, you know, there's not, it's not easy because you're constantly bouncing around and people are like very, and you know, D&D is like the Uber game, I believe, as even Matt Colville has said. It's like, it is the Ur game. You know, you can make it do a lot of things and people are very familiar with it, but I don't know. I, you know, there's, that's a different podcast. I don't, there's,
yeah, that makes sense.
There literally again, is a podcast called One Shot Podcast that literally do that. So you can go listen to that.
I think that's different people too. I think that, I think a lot of people, like a lot of DMs, I think are really into systems. And so we have a lot of DMs who come to our event that pitch weird systems and they are like so excited about it. But then they very rarely get players. The players just want what they're familiar with. Players, like, they're new to it. A lot of them are, at least at our event. And they just learned 5e. Like, they don't even really have a good grasp of 5th edition. They definitely are not ready to, like, break out into Shadowrun or, you know, Vampire the Masquerade. That they're not old hat like a lot of the DMs are. They're less excited about all those systems. But you got to find that good match. But if you, Robbie, found, like, the right group, there would probably be some people who, like, they would be so into that. Like, a new system every week, that'd be amazing. So you want to set those expectations. You want to have a conversation, have a pitch, basically, where you can make sure the players and the DM match up well. And I think our whole event that we do in Atlanta is based on that idea, and it works really well for us. We have people actually pitch. They throw out their idea. The players choose the right table for them. Low commitment. It all ends that night. And so they can try out something new every week until they find the perfect fit. I think that that's something you can apply at your own table, too. But I think that's the philosophy of what we do.
Talk to people. It's pretty good.
Yeah, it's good. It's scary, but
Yeah, it kind of can be. Mm-hmm. Do you want to plug anything, Brad? If there are people in Atlanta, again, where can they go to play game?
So we are at Joystick Game Bar, and it's in the old 4th Ward, like on Edgewood Avenue, near my alma mater, Georgia State University. And we're there every Monday and Tuesday from 7 to 10. And at 6, we have DM Happy Hour, which is an hour before the other games start. And if you want to check us out online, we are atldnd.com. So that's Atlanta Drunks and Dragons. We are atldnd.com.
That's D and D with the A and D.
No, not ampersand. No ampersand. It's D and D. Let me clarify. It is ATL for Atlanta. ATL D N N as in Nicholas.
Right.
DND.com. ATLDND.com. So but that is good to specify because
if anyone listening is in the Atlanta area, there you go. You can go play some games. Have fun. Anything else you want to plug? Aside from that?
I'm really excited about this event. I think that the tickets go on sale actually in like 3 hours, but we're doing a bar crawl. That's the only one I know of, but it's a Dungeons & Dragons bar crawl where we are taking 12 Dungeon Masters in 3 bars, 4 tables per bar. So it's basically one mega dungeon split among 3 bars. So you start in one bar, and then at a certain point, you and your whole party stand up and move to the next bar, sit down, and continue the adventure. So it's like one shared dungeon world split among different bars in the old 4th Ward of Atlanta. So that'll be a really special event. It's June 23rd. Hopefully by the time anyone hears this, tickets will be sold out. But if not, you're welcome to buy one and come out and join us. Hopefully we'll be doing more of these if it works out well. We also could use volunteers if anyone's interested in that.
I have no idea what my listenership is in Atlanta, but I would bet there's at least
that we're doing it. I think it's a cool. I've never heard of anyone else doing it in a D&D bar crawl, so I'm excited about us doing it.
I would bet there's one out there at least.
Yeah, I think you're right. We can't be that original, but still.
No, I mean, pretty cool. I was going to say there's at least one. I have one listener in the Atlanta area, but.
Oh, I thought you meant someone else had done the bar crawl. I thought you were telling me
unoriginal. No. But I mean, you are unoriginal, but I was speaking.
Yeah, it's pretty contrived, honestly. Yeah, I hear you.
I mean, I've never heard of the thing. I'll say that. But, you know, it's the Rule 34. If there's no idea is original anymore. Everyone's done everything.
Dungeons & Dragons bar crawl porn.
That's exactly what I was saying.
All right. If there wasn't before, maybe there will be.
I believe Soldier Boy is selling them on his website, I think.
Okay. I think we've put it out into the universe, and so I think we just the secreted like that. So I think it's probably going to exist coming up soon.
I have a link to that on the show notes for this, so if you are in the area. Or if you are a DM out there and you want to steal Brad's idea.
I would be totally cool with that, actually. Like, we just want to... spread the joy of the hobby. And I think if more people want to do events like ours, or if they're interested in starting an event locally, some people have hit me up about advice or whatever. Like, I don't know, our scene is so different and like things are so different and weird here, but I definitely think I think that our big brainwave was the DM pitch mechanic and getting the bar to like give the DMs a little bit of a reward. I think those two things are the secret sauce that makes it work. So steal those ideas, please.
Steal those ideas. Brad, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's always fun. I appreciate you. Thank you.
Thanks again to Brad for joining me. You can find me on Twitter at Robbie Dorman, and the show's website is SerialFanaticist.com. You can follow our Facebook page at Facebook.com/SerialFanaticist. If you like the show, please give it a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or Google Play Music or wherever you listen to it. Helps us out, helps me out, helps the show out. I appreciate it. Until next time, thanks for being a fan.